We're going to get started here. I think it's about 4:35. And I think all our waves have come through, all our waves of folks. So welcome to the Creative Writing Awards for 2006, the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English. I'm Jeff Ray, and I'm assistant professor in the English department and co-chair of film studies. This is my year, thankfully, and both regretfully. Not regretfully. It was wonderful. My year to put together the Creative Writing Awards. And, you know, submitting and getting your stuff together for awards or for any kind of reading or anything like that, I think it is just like writing. It is both a pain and a thrill. Because, you know, the important things in writing, whether you're doing poetry, fiction, nonfiction, or screenwriting, which are our categories today, is both to write and to get it read. And so, you know, for some of you, this may have been the first time submitting, and it's important that you get in the habit of making sure that your stuff is the best and making sure that it's pretty well together, making sure that, you know, no kind of errors and things like that. Because, you know, if you're continuing as a writer, and I hope you all are, that's what you're going to be doing. Someone else is always going to be looking at your stuff and in some way judging it, and hopefully in some way offering you encouragement to continue writing and to continue to be a better writer. And so that's what's important, the writing, the reading, and so that's what we did in these awards today. I'm very happy that our judge could be with us today, Paul Beatty, who's going to come here and give us a few words. Paul is a writer that I met, I don't know, 15 years ago maybe, something like that, a long time ago. And he has written a couple volumes of poetry, Big Bang Take Little Bank. Help me, Paul. Joker, Joker, Deuce. Two novels, White Boy Shuffle and Tough. And he recently edited an anthology of African-American humor called Hokum. And so Paul was your reader. And so he's going to come and give us a few words. And then, of course, you know tomorrow that he's doing his reading over in Morrill Hall in the conference room at 4 o'clock. So Paul, come and give the people a few words.
Thanks. I'm not sure what to say. The whole process for me was very awkward, and talking about it is even more so. I was flattered when Jeff asked me to do it, and you know, put it out of my mind, and then, you know, he said, oh, I'm going to send you all this stuff, and got this big packet of submissions. And then, you know, I sit down, and I was like, you know what? I don't believe in doing this. Which is, even though he's right about, you know, this ongoing process of judging, but it's not something that I'm very comfortable doing or being judged, I think, like most of us. And so I have to say, though, that in some ways, in reading the submissions, I was very jealous because it wasn't something that I would have been able to do at your age. You know, I was just even too scared to even think about being a writer for, you know, a number of different issues. And then I was also happy to see that a lot of the stuff was stuff that, you know, was very introspective and also aware of the craft of writing. Sometimes people addressing it directly and indirectly, which I thought, you know, for me was, I hate this word, but a mature point to be at, you know, to just to have these processes working at your age. And there's a bunch of other stuff that I was going to say, but I'm looking forward to hearing the stuff. And the thing I want to say is be encouraged by participating, be encouraged. I don't know whether you won, you didn't win. And if you didn't win, don't be discouraged. When I was getting my master's in fine arts and poetry a long time ago, after the first semester, the teacher came up to me and said, you know, I really think you need to think about doing something else. it was a hard thing to hear. I had, you know, some other people in the department was like, don't listen to her, you're on to something. And where you get your belief from and your motivation, I don't know, maybe you guys are watching this basketball thing and they always say, oh, no one believed in us. So, you know, if that works for you, that works, you know. And so I am as unqualified as the next person in many ways. You know, I have my things of what I like, what I don't like. And then somebody gives you something that you should like and you don't like it. So it wasn't easy, but it was fun. And you guys should all give yourselves a round of applause because you guys really did a good job. And if anybody wants to come up and talk to me, and you know, I'm pretty open about whatever, you know, what my criteria was. There weren't any, but you know, feel free and thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
You know, Paul's pretty much a homebody, so dragging him out of New York and then dragging him here and then actually dragging him up here was, I feel good about that. It's quite a feat. Okay, so here's the deal. First, I want to acknowledge the creative writing faculty that are here, Marcia Aldridge, and Robin Silverglad is here. Diane Wachowski, poet, is here. Anita in the back is here, okay. Bill Penn, who is head of the creative writing program, is off in Italy somewhere. I know he's really mad he can't be here. And who else are we? I think we can get, did we get everyone? Bill, is Bill here? Other screenwriting, Bill? Okay, all right. And so, you know, these are the folks, myself included, you know, you do blood, sweat, and tears over your stuff, and we do blood, sweat, and tears reading your stuff. And and just trying to get it so that it's better, you know, and this is an odd thing, trying to get it so that it's better and it reflects what you are and what you want to be as a writer. And so that you are continually encouraged. And that's, I think that's a tough combination. I think that writing, I'm biased, but I think that writing is probably one of the toughest things to teach. But you know, I didn't do well in calculus, so maybe it was the teacher, I'm not sure. But I do think that writing is difficult because it is so individual and it is so so much a part of you that you actually give up. So I will be quiet and we will get on with this. So here's the deal, here's what we're going to do. We're going to start off with poetry, then we'll go to fiction, then we'll go to nonfiction, and in those three categories, we have the Jim Cash Awards, first, second, and third place. So we'll start with third place and go up. And the first place person, when you come up, we're going to have, we have your copies here of your poetry, the winning poem, the winning creative nonfiction, and the winning fiction. So the first place person, when you come up, we're going to have you come up here and read your winning entry. All right, and then we'll go to the screenwriting. And those are the last set of things that we'll do, okay? Okay. So in poetry, in the Jim Cash Awards, in third place, and this is $100, third place is $100, Robert Fortney. And Robert's poems were Though It Never Stays, Salsa in Form, and Ideas in My Things. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thanks, man. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay. And in second place in poetry, Michael Evans. And Michael's poems submitted were "I'd Like to Thank the Academy," "Skinhead," and "Civil Industries." Thank you, Michael. And our first place poem, the Jim Cash Awards, $300. Nicholas Miller for and Nicholas's entries were "Yellow Snow." Saw a lot of that this winter. "I Got Fat to Avoid Being Mediocre." I have done that myself. And "Cutting the Cord." Congratulations.
Thank you.
And give us a read, man.
Okay. Okay, the first poem is called "Yellow Snow." My daughter made snow angels with the babysitter. Her mother, crying, stepped on one, running into the house, lost in the news. And it came to pass, there were three wise asses that night, following an overcast sky, with their pants at their ankles and bearing gifts, glazed eyes, Bacardi, and mirth. They crowned the winter seraphs with urine-crafted halos and fell to their knees, but the angels never moved. They cared not for the piss on their wings, for there was no birth, no flight. Once, we thought to explain Mommy pregnant with the Bible, yet Mary never miscarried, and Mommy wasn't virgin. I got fat to avoid being mediocre. His pencil scratches the doorway, invisible. My graphite name over 293 million other names, already marked, already written. I told him I failed statistics, continued to squirm, unable to stand still for uncle, held me up, fighting against his large graph of 26-year-old white males, married with one dependent, highest level of school completed, high school, and some college. Upset, I ran straight to McDonald's, afraid of getting lost in the crest of people, riding a comfortable bell curve, 293 million nameless, undistinguished, collective, middle class, majority. I ordered the last supersized meal and ate until I was exceptional, got fat, made myself too big for the doorway, for uncle. Only then I knew I was in the 90th percentile for something. My last poem's called "Cutting the Cord." No cord, not like my vacuum at home, nothing like the clean grooves and sturdy plastic of that model, requiring but a quick tug to reel it in, store inside. Instead, plugged in between the stirrups, no cord, a hose, filled with melted crayons scraped off baseboard heaters and tucked beneath couch cushions, 3 inches of suction in periwinkle and hot magenta. Eyes watched from a still body, the pulsing blue-pink tube hoovering out from where the doctor cleaned to where the belly button should have been. A resident handed me scissors and put a kink in the hose, no cord, 3 snips and the colors darken, a dying cord sucking lifeless ashes, my chimney-skinned, malleable child. It didn't retract, nor did I dare tug, while the nurse kneaded my daughter's scalp into newborn screams. Nobody else was fazed that she screamed, wanting crayons we'd taken away, a child's face scribbled in deepening plum. I tried to look, to find any color to placate a child unplugged, but the doctor already changed the bag, offering but a glance at the old one, deflated and brick red, in a pan at my wife's feet.
Okay, next up. Creative nonfiction.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Yes.
Could somebody tell me what creative nonfiction is?
Come on, professors. What's going on? No, we're going to do creative nonfiction. Well, I think Paul will be taking answers afterwards, and you can talk to some of these folks.
I love the term. I think it's
all right, creative nonfiction. Third place. Actually, we have a third place tie, so we have two third places. About Trains, Veronica Fitzpatrick. And our other third place, On Loss in Laughter, Catherine Beringer. Second place, Queer, Michael Evans. First place, Lessons in 88 Steps, Lauren Linalata.
Congratulations.
Now, Lauren's got a pretty long piece here, yeah. So we're going to give her a limit, because she'll go on and on and on and on. Okay, so.
Till there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or can you think of a more appropriate stopping place?
No, I think that's good.
Is that cool?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good.
Hi. Okay. This is called A Lesson in 88 Steps. For my 6th birthday, my mother pulls out one of her crushed silk Italian scarves and ties it around my eyes. I strain against the filtered light, wanting so badly to know what the surprise will be, what it is that I've been anticipating for weeks. I snuck out to the garage last night and saw the bulky shape of a dollhouse hiding under a bedsheet. One of the old threadbare ones that my father uses for painting. And I know, I just know, that tonight will be the night. All the shingles will be in place, and the little doll family will wait for me in their little doll living room. My Siamese cat will sneak onto the wraparound porch of the house, peering in through windows and stealing doll clothes, a great fuzzy terror for the small family of five that resides within. I know this with a certainty that fills my every bone. My mother steers me out into the living room, and I brush against a picture window. The glass is cold, and it's already dark out, despite it being mid-afternoon. Decembers in Missouri get dark faster than any place my mother's ever seen. She says this often. The light is low and orange through the scarf as she turns me, hands big and gentle on my tiny shoulders, and my bare feet shift through the deep pile carpet. She stops me next to the couch, where there is a bare expanse of wall, just the right size for the bulk under the sheet. Ready, she asks, and sounds pleased with herself. I nod so fast it makes my ponytail swing, and I hear her laugh before she puts her hands on either side of my head, gently stilling the motion. Easy, she says, a smile in her voice, and she unties the scarf. My vision swims a little before it rights itself, and the disappointment is crushing. This is no dollhouse. This is not even the right size for the bulk under the sheet in the garage. I cannot keep the distress off my face, and my father, who is sitting on the arm of the sofa, immediately reflects the expression. Don't you like it, he asks, and puts one hand on the tiny stand-up piano possessively. I know almost immediately that this means that he and my mother have had a disagreement about whether or not to get me one at all. I don't know how to play, I blurt, the only thing I can think of, as though my parents would be unaware of this fact. It's small and tan and backed up against the wall, not like the curvy, beautiful pianos from the movies. It's like something out of a cartoon, and I want to open the top and peer down inside to see if anything is living in it. They bid me to sit on the wide bench that is long enough for two people and upholstered in a fraying blue and green pattern. I do, and my dad lifts the bench and I up together to move me close to the piano. My feet don't reach the pedals. I plunk half-heartedly at a random black key and notice that one of the white ones has a hairline fracture right down the middle. My mother tells me that I will be starting lessons after Christmas. I do not resent the piano because I received the dollhouse for Christmas not 2 weeks later. But the prospect of receiving lessons as a birthday gift violates some greater principle in life, and it unsettles me deeply. My piano teacher, Phyllis Hyken, is a tiny ancient Jewish woman with a fierce temper. Her home is not one that has had children in it for many, many years. Too much of the decor gleams in shades of white and cream, and all the visiting students must remove their shoes at the door to protect her pristine carpeting. Her expansive living room houses not one concert grand, but two, one on which the students may play, fumbling and awkward and out of joint, and one for her own use. The pianos, cream and charcoal, are wrapped together at the elegant curve, hugging one another so tightly that I can see her bowed and pinched face from my own bench when she sits down to play. I can watch the hammers fall and rise to strike the strings reflected in the raised lid, and the songs she plays crash around me. I bite my lip and try not to swing my legs and to sit up straight. It is rumor among her other students that once a certain skill level is reached, her priceless Steinway can be practiced upon. But for now, she begins the transfer of rudimentary knowledge that will be the foundation of my skills. She teaches me how to measure a proper posture away from the keyboard and how to curl my fingers like I am holding a delicate bubble in my palm, and how to keep my wrists even as I play. The pieces given to me by Mrs. Hyken are impossible to learn. I practice for an hour every day, and I fill out a timesheet signed by my parents. There are theory books with dancing cartoon eighth notes that wave their hands and smile and teach me about the circle of fifths. There are flashcards to learn the different scales. There is an ominous mechanical metronome that clicks out the dying heartbeat of every moment I spend playing. There is a computer program I must fulfill in her study after each lesson, the technology so ancient that it comes on discs the size of sliced bread, with a hole with the width of a quarter in the middle. My father waits on the sofa, bored, as I struggle through the mechanics of composition. The songs I am given to practice are either too boring for my age, Mary Had a Little Lamb is far past, or too difficult for me to play with my small hands. I sit at home, straining to reach the pedals, fingers aching as I stretch and stretch and stretch for the keys. I can hear my mother in the kitchen making dinner, and I become so frustrated with my plight that I lay my forehead against the keyboard cover and cry quietly, and listen to the music of the clink of plates and glasses that filter in from the other room. At school, I am the only student in my grade who wants to be in the band and cannot be, because my instrument is not one that can be carried to and from school on the bus. My friends wrestle with their proudly rented instruments, far too large for their grade school heights, and demonstrate a newly acquired ability to play theme songs from our favorite television shows and movies at half tempo. I yearn to be able to play these songs as well and ask to borrow their sheet music. Some of them look at me, puzzled, and explain that they do not have music, they just know what sounds right. One girl plays a pop song on her violin, and I ask who composed it, and everyone looks at me with the wary but fond expression of infallible friendship. I do not know these names, Janet Jackson, Vanilla Ice, New Kids on the Block. Until I am 11 years old, the only tapes and CDs I have are by Brahms, Vivaldi, Mozart, Boccherini, Joplin. Names my friends have never heard of. My piano teacher assures me that music is the universal language, and I assure her that no, it is quite possible for it to be a foreign tongue. When my mother tells me that we are going to move, my immediate thought is of the piano, and the sudden confusion of whether or not I want it coming along sends a hot burn in my throat. This is a chance for escape, but guilt keeps me from fully appreciating the moment. She misinterprets my strife and tells me, in what she thinks is a reassuring way, that it will not be left behind, and something like disappointment wells in me. My cousin Chris, old and wise and about to graduate from high school, takes me down to the basement of my aunt's house one night to show me the old piano that he used to play. He sits on the bench and pats the space next to him. I started when I was 6'2", he says, and creaks open the scratched cover. It too is ugly, like my own stand-up piano. The keys are nearly yellow, and I cannot help but think that if I only had a better instrument, I would be a better musician. This thing hasn't been tuned in maybe 5 years. He tests middle C and grimaces. I grimace back, though I'm not sure why. I have not at this age heard of perfect pitch or what discord sounds like to a person who has it. I lean close and watch as he puts his long fingers on the keys and presses down. A dusty chord comes out. I don't like playing, I whisper in the reverb of the notes. Neither did I, he says wistfully, and runs a minor scale up and down the keys so fast that it makes his fingers blur. I stopped 2 years ago. His right hand rambles the melody to Fur Elise, and I crow that I know the song and stumble over Beethoven's name. He grins down at me, his crooked smile that goes all the way into his eyes. I wish I'd never stopped, he says, but school, you know. He shrugs. I nod vehemently. I do not know. I have no idea. But I can easily understand the excuse to want to stop. I contemplate trying this excuse on my parents and dismiss it just as quickly. You should keep playing, he says. It's the first time anyone has told me this. It's worth a lot when you're older. He runs through another tune I don't know, something happy and cheerful that makes his fingers reach far, a 10-key spread from thumb to pinky. Then you can play Christmas carols when you come to visit. The weight of the move crushes down on me in that single sentence. The idea that I will be leaving this place, this comfortable, musty darkness filled with family. And I huddle a little closer to his side. If he notices, he says nothing. I lift up my hands and put them on the bottom half of the keyboard. He tells me we're going to play a duet, which I've only seen my piano teacher play with her piano teacher friends at our recitals. He teaches me my part, and then he plays his, and then we put them together. By the time I leave the basement, I know both parts to heart and soul.
Very good. Now I have a little bit more sympathy for my two boys taking piano. I'm gonna be a little bit nicer. Okay, fiction. We're off to the fiction awards. Third place in the Jim Cash Awards for fiction. Karen O'Connor. Did I say the name of it? The Translator? I'm sorry, Karen. The Translator. Second place. The Staging Ground. Lauren, I'm killing your name, I'm sorry. Lauren Linsalata. Okay, first place in fiction, Spin Cycle, Nicholas Miller.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Have some money.
Thank you.
Where are we here? This is five. So okay. I think for.
Okay.
Or whatever you feel.
Sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Okay, this is called Spin Cycle. Maria de Guadalupe held one arm below her sacred heart, her cupped hand cradling the rigid letters, Hecho en México. Soren had purchased her 3 months ago, after spending the night on a park bench near the local cemetery. He'd eaten a lime for dinner that night, with a side of Coronas, and awoke the next day to the gritos of street vendors. They wanted 10 pesos for her. He talked them down to 5. Now, suction cupped to the dashboard of his weathered Beetle, Maria stood mere inches above the cassette deck. A cracked tape of George Winston had been on repeat all night. With her other arm, Maria pressed a small clock against her stomach, set at 3. The digits hadn't changed since he'd bought her, and Soren no longer cared. Time held little importance of late. He sat in the car for several breaths before getting out, caught up in the reflection. He hadn't thought of the girl in weeks, a sure sign he needed laundry done. She only surfaced here, at the laundromat, several hours after burying the sun. Here, where a warped laundry basket served to remind Soren of his own life losing shape. Rummaging through the back seat, he collected a pile of dirty clothes and stuffed them into the misshapen container. He shook the tide to see if there was enough left, shut the door with his foot, and waited inside, past the rows of lint-filled waste baskets. Without breaking the shared silence, Soren burrowed into the stainless steel plot near the window and shoveled his whites into the coin-operated tombstones. Grave markers poked up from an autumn earth near the festivities. Color breathed on the grounds of the small village in northern Baja California. Being El Día de los Muertos, the cemetery was littered with tortillas and toy skeletons. Card tables bridged grave sites, and porcelain saints held half-empty cervezas for those who'd forgotten. She watched as children traced goblets in the dirt. Restless, she walked beyond the smell of tacos al pastor into an older section of the grounds. Her cracked fingernails ran along a nearby headstone, and she crossed herself out of habit before La Virgen, perched silently upon a weathered sepulcher. She curtsied and introduced herself as Iris, though her parents had named her Esperanza. Maria had nothing to say. Iris had been raised in this village, though she now lived and worked near Tijuana, catering to arrogant canos. In the summer, she sold cheap trinkets and braided the blonde curls of tourism. Occasionally, she joined friends at the clubs to practice her English, earning extra money by dancing with the gringos. She hadn't been in 3 months. The wind picked up as Esperanza left the grounds and headed toward the coast. There, she watched salt-ridden crests topple the debris left by drunken tourists, then dissipate into suds and swollen memories. The suds continued to pull at his clothing,
spinning the colors in a soapy undertow. A hybrid city tucked into the southeastern corner of the map, San Isidro had only one night lavanderia. Bilingual signs framed the cement homes and zero-car garages of Soren's Purgatory. Pinned tightly between San Diego and the border with Tijuana, he wrapped himself between cultures, evading the judgment of each. He was always overwhelmed by how many people washed clothing at this hour. The only gringo, he waited between umber housewives, their fingers neatly folding the whites. He made offerings to the 25-cent slots, watching each time as washers came alive, building to a faint whir. Clothing clung to glass, the moisture overtaking the fabric as it sank in the stormy waters. Soren twisted his head with a pair of black swim trunks, watching them spin in motionless circles. After several revolutions, he lost them completely. It took half an hour to finish the first load. He put in another armful of colors, letting the nearby dryer run its cycle. He couldn't bring himself to sort, and tossed clean clothes into the basket unfolded, distracting himself with a washer once more. His eyes were drawn to a white sock thrown in by mistake, resurfacing against the window continuously. Heavy eyes dozed to the cleansing scents of detergent and bleach. Bleach had taken the grass stains out, though she continued to scrub with chapped knuckles to remove the memories. She'd washed that shirt every day for months, though it no longer fit. Esperanza had worn it that night, with the horrible dancer, a handsome güero who spoke moderate Spanish. Her friends attached to his party immediately, and he asked her to dance. Another girl tried to cut in, but he sent her off with his eyes. Later sent his friends away as well. He'd said something to her that night, whispered it as soft as a confession, something foreign. Fiancé, fiancé, she had no idea. It sounded French to her, maybe Italian. What it meant was unimportant. She just liked the way he said it. Nausea forced her to the bathroom for the third time that morning. A cold shower refreshed her, a momentary respite from the pain. She numbly made her way to the bedroom, ducking from the rosary beads her mother hung in the doorway. She'd moved in with them after becoming sick, though they hadn't spoken a word to her in months. Her mother just hung beads throughout the house and asked the cura to speak with her. Esperanza, Magdalena, Alemia, Marquez. He enunciated each syllable in staccato voice. Priestly robes pardoned her name by name, reminded her of that night. My name is Iris. Her broken words now sounded foreign, echoing distant in her head. The bedroom had remained relatively unchanged since her youth. The altar they'd built to Maria for her confirmation had been repainted, the Virgin's robes now a deepening plum. A picture of her quinceañera had been hung by the dresser. It all felt uncomfortable, like home. She slumped to the tile floor, pulled her knees up to her chin, and closed her eyes. The cold floor vibrated to the rhythm of commercial dryers. Soren opened his eyes and stood up, rubbing his back pocket, numb at the wallet. Picking sleep from his eyes, he looked through the thinning laundromat crowd. The final load had been dry for some time. He opened the dryer door, pulled lumps of once warm clothing into his basket, and took several steps toward the door. Espera, a voice called. Please wait. Turning his head, he saw a young woman running toward him, trying to catch his attention in fragments of English. Swallowing his breath, Soren dropped the basket and grabbed her by the arms. Sorry, he whispered to her face, dizzied by his lack of sleep and the intoxicating bleach. I'm so sorry. Confused, she lowered a pair of uncertain eyes to the floor. Releasing her arms, he took her chin firmly in his hand and pressed her mouth to his. The force split her lip as her teeth grated against his. Struggling in muffled surprise, the woman pushed herself away and to the floor. The illusion was broken, merely a young woman with terrified eyes. She kept glancing at his basket, the clothing now thrown to the floor. A pair of briefs hugged a small purple blouse, and an argyle sock snuck its way into an unsuspecting bra. Only then he realized that he'd grabbed her clothing by mistake. This woman was using the dryer next to him, only stopped him to get her clothing back. Distantly, he apologized, and an awkward silence helped sort the baskets, the contents mingling on the linoleum. Her clothing in place, the woman hurried away. His eyes moved with the machine in front of him, trailing a brunette shoe. It must have been thrown in by mistake. Dancing wild circles through the water, the errant shoe animated the clothing as it moved. It had been her who'd danced around him that night, a falling maple seed spinning tight curves on a near-empty dance floor, the brunette for whom he'd abandoned his friends. Four groomsmen he lost that night, plus his best man and an uncle he'd never invited. They called for him early that evening, said enough was enough. She took him to another club, and then a third, before walking through a cemetery with kisses. After waking alone, he never returned home. Not for the rehearsal dinner, not for the wedding. Soren lost them when he didn't go back. Instead, he spent that week on a park bench in Tijuana, bought a 5-peso clock, and later moved to San Isidro. Still kneeling on the laundromat floor, Soren let his eyes follow the washer until it eventually stalled and callously stopped spinning altogether. Knees dirty, she stood and looked around the field. She'd been helping her father in El Campo every morning, despite her mother's silent protests. They still weren't speaking, though Esperanza felt their shame. Defiant, she picked the dirt from her nails and kicked off her shoes.
Digging her toes into the soil, Iris planted herself between the rows of maíz, one arm cradling the burden, hecho en México. Streaks of amarillo cut the darkening sky, her silhouette a colorless stain against Empyrean. She left for Tijuana the next morning. Passing through the outskirts of the city, she stopped by a group of señoras washing their clothing in old drywall buckets. With broken broomsticks lodged into empty Coke bottles, the ladies churned the foamy waters. Rhythmically, they spun the ropa, purged its manchas and the aftertaste of hard work. Esperanza turned away from the dizzying waters and walked on. She couldn't afford to live a life of motion, never settling anywhere. She circled the plaza several times before finding a destination. There was no eye contact when she walked in and none when she left. Instead, everyone in the room kept their thoughts on the checkered floor below, worn thin from years of service. Other than the tiny altar to Maria near the desk, the room was completely sterile. Time was lost, and Esperanza was unsure exactly how long she waited. White men came and went, asked her to fill out forms with her full name, and then gave her a cloth bag to take home. Her turn finally came. Esperanza ducked under the rosary beads in the doorway, winking at Maria, who said nothing. Maria remained silent as he tossed the basket in the trunk. Slamming the door, Soren choked the steering wheel with his decision. Fleeing the signs which welcomed him in two languages, he sped toward the nearest highway entrance ramp, wheels spinning as he climbed in tight circles. For miles, he raced toward an elusive horizon, getting off before the customs sign. Maria clung to three as he sped around the cloverleaf and headed back in the other direction. Soren chased the dawn, his twilight countenance framed in blossoming purple, accented with the yellow highlights of day. Nearing San Diego, an abandoned pass turned his wheel again. Over and over, tires screeched along the highway ramps, driving him in endless circles toward nowhere. Soren drove in desperation, looking for anywhere but in between, willing to settle for hell if he could find it.
Right. I would like to thank Peter Berg for accommodating us, even though they had things going on in here. Thank you so much, Peter. And I would also like to acknowledge the most important person in this room, Ruth Mowry, who gets y'all. Who has y'all on the road to graduation, or at least like saying, is that a way? Please. Okay. Let's move to the screenwriting awards. And this year we have two sets of awards for screenwriting. We have the Jim Cash Awards for second and third place, and we have the Swarthout Prize. And so we'll begin with the Jim Cash Awards, and we'll have the first place person to read a treatment, I hope. Okay. The Jim Cash Creative Writing Awards for screenwriting. And this is an area, I'm sorry, I'm just keep yakking, but this is an area that has really grown a lot. I teach it, so I've seen over the years the quality of the work just get better and better and better. And I keep saying, when my screenwriters become millionaires, don't forget about me, please. Okay. Third place in the Jim Cash Awards, The Plagiarist, Zach Pohl. Second place in the Jim Cash Awards, For the Love of the Lonely, Alex, help me with your last name, Alex. Ramey. Alex Ramey. Sorry, Alex.
No, that's good. Congratulations.
And first place in the Jim Cash Awards for screenplay, Ben the Impaler, Patrick Walchick. The title alone will get you. Okay.
I think this is the right one. All right. All right. Ben the Impaler is a story about a guy named Ben and the life he leads. He owns his own business, a pizza shop. He's been in a serious relationship with his girlfriend, Megan, a florist, for 5 years, and they're still deeply in love. His two best friends are a homophobic gay couple, Dave and Dave. One owns a blood bank. And, well, Ben's a vampire. Although he's a vampire, he can do everything a human can. He has reflection, he can eat garlic, and he can walk in the sun. His downfall is he needs blood every few weeks to survive, which he gets from Dave. While Dave and Dave know that he's a vampire, he still hides it from Megan. Ben lives day to day quite content where he is in his life, taking the good with the bad, from his girlfriend making him watch horror movies, which he's terrified of, to dealing with his friends verbally attacking homosexuals. He takes it all with a grain of salt. The good in his life vastly outweighs the bad. Eventually, Dave and Dave trick Ben and Megan into going to a gay pride parade to protest, during which Dave and Dave play a game to piss off people in the crowd, which causes a man to try to kill Dave later that night. Ben takes a bullet, because a man tries to shoot him, and unbeknownst to Ben, he kills him, and eventually, during which Dungeons & Dragons geek sees him. Ben goes home with Dave and Dave that night and clean up. After the murder, Ben's quite shaken. He can't remember the last time he killed a person, and now it's all over the papers and the news. And to top it off, Megan's getting closer to finding the truth that he's a vampire. Eventually, the Dungeons & Dragons geeks track Ben down and blackmail him into turning them into vampires. With the help of Dave and Dave, he pretends to, and afterwards they go on a killing spree for blood, which they don't need. Ben figures out what's going on and hatches a plan with Dave and Dave to take care of the kids.
And that's a comedy, right? Is that right? Okay. 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 Our Swarthout prize. And we have two places in the Swarthouts. And this one is for second place. One Dozen Black Roses, Francis Howes. And our first place in the Swarthout Prize is Night Runners, Chris Getz.
I don't quite have the treatment that Patrick had. Just a few lines. Mine's not really as plot-driven, I guess. Night Runners is the story of two MSU freshmen who, like most 18-year-olds away from the restraints of home for the first time, explore themselves and each other. Matt and Tyler become friends right away, running together at night and eating meals together during the day. It takes a bit of time, however, for them to fall in love. The screenplay tries to explore this relationship and to grapple with the feeling that Matt and Tyler's love for one another is really little more than the novelty of being away at college.
Okay. Well, folks, we have done awards.
Can I make one more announcement?
Yes, you can. I was on that committee, and I knew days ago, and every time I saw you, I had to shut my mouth. I was talking about Veronica, not telling you. Okay. Folks, thank you for coming out. I just want to, again, make sure that you know tomorrow, our judge, Paul Beatty, is doing a reading of his works from 4 to 5:30, 213 Morrill Hall, the conference room. It's on the second floor in the English department. Paul is also speaking in our screenwriting class tomorrow at 10 a.m. So, yeah, they laugh, 10 a.m. So if a few of you who are not in screenwriting want to come on through, feel free to come on through, bring coffee and donuts. Just wonderful, wonderful writing. And again, we would encourage you to continue, keep striving. You know, writers write. That's my mantra, writers write. So keep writing, do your thing, find your voice, get good, get better, get great. And again, if you make a lot of money, don't forget about us. Okay? So thank you for coming out. We appreciate it.